Hello and welcome everyone. My name is Orizuma Seni, and it's a great pleasure welcoming to the New York Public Library the acclaimed architects Marianne Weiss and Michael Manfredi, and the distinguished guests, architecture critic Alexandra Lang, urban thinker and executive director of New York Van Allen Institute, David Van der Leer, and revered architect and professor of architecture at Princeton University, Stan Allen. We're here tonight to celebrate the publication of Public Natures with a presentation by Marianne Weiss and Michael Manfredi, followed by a discussion moderated by Alexandra Lang, exploring the potential of shaping a new public realm. In their new book, Public Natures, Evolutionary Infrastructures, Marianne Weiss and Michael Manfredi speculate that a new paradigm for infrastructure might erase the hard lines between landscape, architecture, engineering, and urbanism, suggesting a more synthetic definition of infrastructure that is entirely public in nature. This unprecedented monograph features essays, roundtable discussions, and selected projects that identify new terms, conditions, and models that insist architecture must evolve to create more productive connections between landscape, architecture, and urban territories. I'd like to thank our guests for appearing in an Architectural Explorations in Books series event, delving into the critical role that architecture publications play in the understanding of contemporary urban developments and structures. Copies of Public Natures, Evolutionary Infrastructures are available at a special discount price of $40 at the end of the program. I see many young faces in the audience tonight. I hope you find tonight's program inspiring. I also like to encourage you to visit the art collection at Mid-Manhattan Library, located at 455 Fifth Avenue, where you can freely and openly browse the largest circulating collection of books and videos covering every aspect of architecture and urban studies. Thank you all for your attendance, and now it's time to turn the floor to our guests.
Well, thank you, Arizu, for your most generous introduction. It's a great pleasure to have this conversation, if you will, at the New York Public Library, which is, I think, we're reminded as we enter this rather grand and very beautiful ascending stair that this is an institution that embodies the idea that books should, first and foremost, be public and available to all. Our own much more modest book, Evolutionary Infrastructures, shares this conviction, and we believe that public natures can be created in improbable settings ranging from the nanoscale to the territorial, equally shaped and in anticipation of yet-to-be-discovered ecological and social infrastructures. Now, this book grew out, as many books do, out of a series of preoccupations that have been tested in our own projects and extended through a series of conversations with colleagues, students, and fellow teachers in research studios both at Penn and at Harvard over the last couple years. We're especially grateful to Princeton Architectural Press, our publishers, for believing in this project, and I think for their great patience. Likewise, projects, ideal graphic designers, to shape this rather complex visual narrative. And lastly, but not leastly, to Justin Fowler and Allison Wicks, our insightful, inspired editors who propelled and cajoled this improbable adventure forward. I think in terms of the content of the book, we have to, I think, note that it represents the collective talents and commitments of members of our studio who always provoke us and propel us and very much shape the content of the book and the projects that you'll see.
I think this evening we're really excited to, share a kind of snapshot into the book, a snapshot into Public Natures, Evolutionary Infrastructures, and more importantly, extend the kind of open-ended conversation that actually launched the book and shaped the ideas with distinguished colleagues and friends. So this evening, in fact, joining us, Stan Allen, who's an urbanist, architect, and Princeton professor, David Vandeleer, director of the Van Allen Institute and curator of artistic and urban debates, and moderator Alexandra Lang, who's author, educator, and design critic, and persistent provocateur, will be provoking us a little bit later at the end of our brief presentation. But the book has been really greatly inspired by our keen interest that there's really a broader potential to shape a public terrain that's no longer just finite that says public, but in fact could extend to larger infrastructures. And in fact, we have this conviction that maybe art and ecology, design and nature, architecture and infrastructure are really bound together not as separate disciplines, but in reciprocity. So each project this evening really is part of an evolving experiment in our interest in defining a more elastic definition of design. And it's one that really attempts to connect the loose ends of architecture, ecology, and infrastructure to create some new form of public nature. So if new forms of ecological and social systems are a hallmark of contemporary debates, then what we are curious about is this strange kind of ambiguous question of what, in fact, an evolutionary infrastructure could mean. And in this case, we look at the book really as a kind of collection of chapters, one that we call Evolutionary Infrastructures and captures a collection of projects, some of which you'll see. And the other is to really extend this to something a little bit more elusive, less physically explicit, but of social infrastructures. And those social infrastructures and ecological ones actually lead us to that conversation that we're very interested in having and hosting, both at Penn and at Harvard, with a series of colleagues and friends. And we teased apart a series of terms and conditions as a way of setting up something maybe that's been explored before, but could be explored in fresh terms. And indeed, the debate about the book and what's captured within these pages, what's black and white and what is in color, was already the debate that was hosted with our incredible designers of Project Projects. But I think for us, these two images are quite intriguing because they really look at this ambiguous nature of what is natural and what is constructed, what is hard and what is soft. And in effect, both inspirations here to the artists Tom and Cole and Roe Etheridge with Junkland, Atlanta. But this question of what is man-made and what is natural and what happens when these worlds come together was never more vivid in terms of the infrastructural failure that Hurricane Sandy provoked, and actually makes this a very contemporary preoccupation for us.
So I think our conversation extends, if you are generous, a couple hundred years. I think we're reminded that this idea of a network of infrastructure is not a new idea, and historically great examples of urbanism have prioritized design, and I think one can start to see how Pope Sixtus's visionary idea of Rome in a way is as contemporary as you might imagine it. Similarly, Joseph Plechnik's Ljubljana River Promenade is both an ecological attempt to control flooding as it is an expression of civic pride. We're also, it's hard not to be, in a way, stimulated by Le Corbusier's integration of highway and inhabitation, or Furness's almost obsessive array of bridges across the Hudson and across the East River. Similarly, we admire, and I think stand on the shoulders, of Rudolph's utopian dream to somehow cover highways, or I suppose, in a way, humanize those highways. But no less interesting for us is the contingent megaform. And I think Stan's talked a lot in his own work about the idea of megaform. It's been important to us. And this idea of utopia realized, perhaps incrementally and perhaps tangentially, is no less powerful than some of the earlier examples. Similarly, closer to home, the Brooklyn Heights Promenade, which is surely, in our opinion, one of the great integrations of highway and park. Incredible sectional bravura. It surely is one of the great examples of urban design anywhere.
So this preoccupation with what could be larger in section and in territory is something that we've been preoccupied with for a long time, and we were extraordinarily thrilled when the Olympic Sculpture Park came along as an international competition. And now this is a public realm being hosted by a museum. It's hard to imagine anything more amazing than that. A site divided by an arterial highway and train lines, contaminated because of the Union Oil of California, and a failing seawall. And we thought, what an amazing landscape to set up for art. So we imagined this whole infrastructural earthwork landscape as something that could wander from the city to the water's edge and connect this entirely divided place into something thoroughly connected through the lens of art and ecology. Now, easier said than done. In fact, it was a lot of head scratching and a back and forth about this issue of simultaneities from a Kunsthal, a bridge, two bridges, salmon habitat restoration if we wanted to get $2 million of federal funding. All these things seen together as something that truly benefited, in this case, from a reciprocal earthwork of an excavation in downtown to contribute 360,000 cubic yards of earth to construct something that was entirely new but entirely infrastructural in the homage, if you will, of a gift of the Olympic Sculpture Park's vista of Calder in the mountains. And that unfolding notion of constructing a landform and a landscape actually scaled down almost in a fractal form into the shaping of this pavilion, this Kunsthal, with parking below, art above. And Richard Serra, his work so valiantly cast here, Wake in the Valley, is one where you could argue that this pavilion-to-nature relationship is somehow simultaneously also a landscape, if you will, for yoga and all kinds of rejuvenating Northwest activities.
We joke, we actually sent this to Richard Serra and told him that they were all bowing down in homage to Wake. He was pleased. But it is about also acknowledging the power of infrastructure, in this case, bridging over a highway rather than completely covering it and denying it. So at times, the road in a way whispers, you can hardly see it. At times, the passage under the park is celebrated in a very emphatic way. Similarly, the kind of trajectory, the path that continues over the train, takes the train lines, often seen as antithetical to urban life, and incorporates them into the composition of the park. And here you see the bridge beautifully framing Teresita Fernandez's Seattle Cloud cover, so that the idea of art as a kind of infrastructural engine can be carried through at a number of scales. But I think one of the things that we're most proud of is the idea of re-engaging Seattle with its waterfront. Often, like many North American cities, the idea of the waterfront has been divorced through the industrialization of the city. But here, I think, in some ways, the park continues, and we imagine that the park descends in this rather beautiful and ephemeral aquatic garden that's primary purpose is to bring back salmon habitat. So in a way, the project is not complete. It continues and does, I think, in many ways, remind us that the temporal and the permanent are not antithetical conditions. So here you see the park on opening day. And we've had an opportunity to kind of go back 5 years since this opening to kind of see how elements are adjusted, contradicted, and played with. Very much a work in progress is Hunters Point Park on the East River, also a waterfront very much divorced from its original intention. But here the park, which is almost a little shy of a mile long, in a way incorporates a series of events, some found events, some constructed events, so that its 10-year cycle will in some ways, I think, change and alter, but the basic DNA of the park will not. So phase one opened not too long ago, a little over a year ago. It's very intensive and active in terms of its programs, play areas, dog runs, places for people to gather and play sports, both programmed and spontaneous. And rather than 10 different pavilions, we gathered one pavilion to frame what could otherwise be a kind of a giant sponge. And sure enough, during Hurricane Sandy, this big playing field absorbed water, detained it, and let it out without damaging the park. So we're now starting phase two, which we're very excited about. So this bluff will become a promontory. It's a chance to kind of reconnect with one of the taller, higher elevations on the East River, along this part of the East River. But we also have an opportunity to return to the pavilion to see how it's performing. It's a kind of net zero building that provides power not only for the building itself, but also for the park. Also collects water in the kind of pleated roof. So it's a kind of hardworking, as much a building as it is a sort of engine. But also, I think we should be reminded that we all deal in the world of the spectacular, the sublime, and what more sublime than this incredible view of Manhattan, a great gift to anybody working on the East River.
I think as Michael is talking about the sublime, the question of what's on the silhouette and what captures our imagination on the horizon is one that also has something to do with Sylvan Theater, a competition that we won with Olin at the Washington Monument to create or recreate Alice Pike Burney's vision of a place of creation and invention and performance on the Mall. But none of you probably have ever seen it, and if you have, you'd see a plywood structure that has right behind it all the tour buses. And that strange sort of phenomenon was one where we thought, why would a theater turn its back to the monument? And why couldn't this funny sleeve of a piece at the edge of the Mall actually be seen not as an edge but as a center between two landscapes, between the tidal basin on one side and the kind of formality of the Mall on the other? And so what we started to look at was how little could we do in this incredibly hallowed landscape by simply lifting the land. And by lifting it on one side, we could create the stage as a center between the monument and the amphitheater and conceal the buses and also actually lift the land for a Sylvan Pavilion for those who come to the monuments with no place to catch your shade or sustenance. That break, if you will, in the landform is one that actually is a suggestion of the beginning, which then actually links and crosses over to the tidal basin. And that gets us to this question of the social and the cultural actually somehow being merged magically, as we like them to be in our book, to look at really the section as the kind of key or the synthetic link between that which is social and that which is infrastructural. So we've been really intrigued with this idea that when we have buildings that are more than one floor, the challenge of a kind of social dynamic, particularly in academic or in office spaces, is very challenging. And in fact, one kind of combination between the academic and entrepreneurial model is taking place right now on Roosevelt Island with Cornell Tech. And we're really excited that this is a building that we're working on, the bridge, which is literally one-third academic, two-thirds entrepreneurial. And it's a purposeful mix to recreate on this kind of island with river-to-river views the idea that what happens in Silicon Valley inefficiently over miles and miles can happen in one building on Roosevelt Island. But it really is amazing that the places of collaboration are really ideally the places where we get the longest horizon and the distant view of Manhattan. Or, in fact, from the core of the campus, a sense that there's two merging crystalline wings that come together for this vertical sort of hourglass of activity to catalyze, we hope, invention and innovation. Now, that whole question of invention and innovation also tracks to corporate settings. And at Novartis, the idea of their oncology headquarters as a true kind of office box is one that's now transformed and inscribed with a landscape of social spaces that carves and ascends all the way up and through the building, so that, in fact, the simultaneity of seeing the place of work above and the place of collaboration below suggests that maybe they are one and the same with different addresses within the same building, and that those two can join the landscape in a way that is both ephemeral and specific and marking those places of collaboration outside as well. Now, this inside-outside academic-urban question, when it has regional ambitions, as the nanotechnology building at Penn has, is quite interesting. But here's a case of the most invisible but most potent science, nanoscience, taking place. And it's a science that is intended to be protected and usually very, very secret and small in scale. But we were really intrigued with this incredible idea that it's the first cross-disciplinary arts and sciences and engineering and regional facility, even if we needed amber light or amber glass to protect every bit of the science happening inside. But that amber protection of the clean room actually provides a strangely luminous glow over green that we identified with the only structurally vibrant space, if you will, the cantilever for social areas above that landscape. So it's this idea of kind of twisting and inverting the notion of the atrium and the public realm and the collaboration spaces that link the kind of pure research spaces that allow you to see up and be seen, and so that even traversing this steep section of 20 vertical feet, almost two floors, which is the requirement of a lab, is now calmed down, if you will, for socializing through these intermediate landings that are dialed in for collaboration and gathering, so that ultimately everybody has an opportunity to see and be seen and have the most vivid connections, if you will, to the city and the campus beyond.
So the idea of the institution in the city, and I think what typically was a clearly defined set of relationships is in fact starting to evaporate, for better or for worse. And I think these were questions that were probed in our project and asked of us, actually, by the trustees at Barnard College, where the intention was to emphatically talk about Barnard's relationship to the city and to create a mixed-use building for Barnard's rather extensive and important arts programs, from creative writing to performance. So how do you inhabit a multi-story building and introduce a set of kind of cross-pollinations? The idea for us, at least, was to create a series of public rooms that would ascend so that you could always see and be seen. Similarly, you could always be aware of your location in the city and in the strata or the geography of the city. So the sense of kind of nourishing, I suppose, or trying to nourish peripheral vision, the idea of looking down into a library, seeing perhaps some of your colleagues study, or looking up to a set of exhibition spaces at the very top of the ascending atria, we give you a sort of sense of how you are navigating in a building, the kind of geography of the building, but also a kind of a panorama of the kinds of programs and activities that your colleagues are engaged in, from the very private to the more expansive, from the sense of the solitary member to being part of a community, being part of a city. Those are the sort of toggles, those scales, that I think we've tried to deal with on a number of projects, including Barnard. So we'll conclude with BBG, the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a very tiny building, but improbably long. The Botanic Garden is only about 65 acres, but is an incredible institution in the city in terms of generating a series of scientific, pedagogical programs, but it's also a place of incredible beauty. So the idea was to create a visitor center that wasn't a destination in and of itself, but would start to work and gather you, in a way seduce you into the garden. The building is about 400 feet long from city to retaining wall in a garden. And how do you navigate a building that's that long? Here we had the benefit of topography, so in a way it becomes a kind of inhabitable topography where the building is very overt and very architectural at the city's edge and then slowly tends to merge into the landscape. And that path is given kind of measure through a series of fritted glass enclosures that allow the kind of dappled light to carry you, in a way become the kind of architectural breadcrumbs that lead you into the garden, and in turn carry a kind of path around and through the garden. In this case, actually, the geometry of the building is very carefully inscribed to track the canopy of this incredibly beautiful and rare cherry tree. It's a green flowering cherry tree, one of the few in North America. So the building, in a way, submits to the landscape.
And I think, you know, the question of submission, particularly to the landscape for a garden, is really important. And so even the interiors here are all about the kind of exhibitions on one side, the garden on the other side. And that kind of wandering Germany actually terminates inside in the only two-sided room in New York that we know of that seats 160 for a wedding. But the idea was to really take that path and grow it for a moment and then taper it down in this leaf shape that dips down so that it actually allows that section, if you will, for the upper arrival from the subway level to actually weave through the building, and the kind of latent leftover that landscape steps up beyond. Now, the amazing thing about this particular green roof is it has 44,000 different plants, and they were very interested in the kind of habitat of these plants and the changing through the seasons. I think they were somewhat delighted, if you will, with some of the habitat that started to show up. somewhat less delighted in the shallow roofscape that they had there for some alternate habitat that, if you will, extended the whole idea of public natures. But in some ways, for us, it really is this question of what are new forms of ecological and social systems if they are the hallmark of contemporary debates, both within the density of cities and at the fragile edges of natural realms, that we somehow believe the stakes of this debate, for us, resist oppositional clarity, nature versus city, individual versus collective. But instead, we think, suggest the possibility of perhaps an evolutionary form of infrastructure and public nature. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Is this working? Yes. No. Okay. They never work. All right. Thank you for that. So I want to return just to something that you touched on more at the beginning of your talk, and which you mentioned in the introduction to the book, which is this notion of program-rich infrastructure. In the book, you spoke about a couple of historical examples that you found particularly kind of instructive or helpful, and one of them was the Brooklyn Heights Promenade, which I think we have a picture of here. And I'd love it if you would talk a little bit more about the promenade and kind of what it means, because I think it's not often talked about as a piece of architecture anymore. It's more a kind of sentimental New York place. And so I love the idea of kind of mixing up what we think of the promenade.
Well, is this working? It's a remarkable kind of invention by Clark and Rockwana, but actually it came from a protest of the Robert Moses proposed, BQE coming through that was going to tear apart this neighborhood, and thankfully 1,000 riders lived there, protested. And then they commissioned, if you will, this independent sort of form of sectional urbanism using the full bluff of the Heights. So the most remarkable element is you've got a local road at the bottom, you've got northbound and southbound traffic in between, and then just the gift of this kind of lamination to the edge of the backyards of all these brownstones at 3/8 of a mile long is both the terminus of the city and the edge that everybody wants to join to see Manhattan. So it has every speed that you can imagine, every population, both fast and slow, passing through or parking there, accommodated in this just barely their twist on what an infrastructural project might mean.
Yeah, I think part of the provocation, and I think it's shared by all of us up here, is that we're living in a world of limited resources, and I think some people are still in denial, but unquestionably that's the case. And what's so beautiful about this particular project is that could it be seen only as a park, it could be seen only as infrastructure, and in a way it's infrastructure that has more work to do, and I think that's for us, the kind of the real message of this particular project. And I think the other message that is even more relevant is that in this increasingly privatized world, this is a public park. And those two things often, I think, increasingly are seen as antithetical.
Mm-hmm. And Stan and David, do you have ideas about other examples in your own experience of this kind of program-rich infrastructure? Or projects that really go the extra mile to be beautiful as well as useful in the city context.
Well, I'd actually like to speak a little bit more about the promenade, because I hadn't made that connection between the promenade and Seattle, but it's very clear in a way. But the thing about the promenade, it's still very stratified. It's basically impossible to get from the promenade down to the waterfront. It's particularly an issue now that there's a park down there. And of course, what you did in Seattle is to de-stratify that infrastructure and the different layers and actually make that connection down to the park. So I think, I can't say I can think of other examples off the top of my head, although I'm sure there are many. I think it has as much to do with the kind of design intelligence that could start with an example like the promenade and then reorganize those layers in a kind of creative way. So it's a little bit less to do with the precedents and more to do with the design impulse that can take that as a jumping off point.
Let me stay on the promenade then too. I was actually a little sad that it's not so easy to see it anymore these days. There is a beauty to it. I think the annoying thing with the system as it is the sound, because there's a beauty to the cars coming by and the whole system of the layering. But the sound makes it a very tough tough space in the city, and I think now it's visually hidden. And of course, to hide the sounds from the new park on the river, so it's kind of sad that we've lost a part of this this system.
That's interesting because I was actually thinking that now with the additions of Brooklyn Bridge Park, there's actually been more infrastructure added to it. I mean, there are the sound attenuating berms, and then there's the Squibb Park Bridge, sadly closed for engineering reasons, that's kind of supposed to do to make up for the fact that you don't have that connectivity across the layers. And I think it's a really good parallel to the Olympic Sculpture Park, which kind of, you know, starts to bend and break the layers into a more flexible system. The other example of that we brought that you also just touched on glancingly was Nervi's bus station in Upper Manhattan, which I understand you did a whole studio on at Harvard. And just if you could talk a little bit about why you brought that to the students and kind of what they made of it.
Yeah, I think we've had this discussion, thinking also with Stan and David. The 50s and 60s were full of utopian dreams that were never realized, these long, infinitely long structures. This is actually, in a way, a kind of utopian dream realized, but done so incrementally, because I think one of the big criticisms of mega projects is they're too large and they never have enough political will behind them to succeed. Well, here, it starts with Amman's amazing GW Bridge, and then Nervi built the bus terminal, and then there were a series of apartment buildings that, while they're not distinguished architecture, were revolutionary at the time because they spanned the highway. So I think what we really loved was the sense that this was a kind of mega project realized, in a way unfinished as well, but it included residential, it included what is now called a mass transit hub, but when Nervi designed it, it was just an incredibly beautiful building. And then surely one of the great pieces of bridge design in the world. And so here it is, right in our own backyard. It's a great example of a kind of megaform built.
And, to some extent, it's a contingent megaform. It was not utopian in that it was a complete vision. It was one that was incrementally built on. Even the GW Bridge's extra lanes were added. And the whole idea of the Port Authority commissioning an Italian architect to design a great bus terminal is so exciting to us. And then to think about that, then somebody was actually carving the highway under there and actually creating 4,000 units of affordable housing to span over that with lightweight construction. It was a revolutionary idea and utter failure. But the fact that this happened was so remarkable that people could think that inhabiting infrastructure, superimposing and gathering these things all at once was in fact a possibility. And this very project then led the Ford Foundation in their excitement about its both potential and failure to commission Rudolph to do that study, that Trans-Manhattan study that you see, to say, can we actually multiply in dense urban settings more than one thing in our infrastructural locations to allow inhabitation to densify our city? So these are truly exciting sectional questions.
Yeah, I have to say I was rather taken by the some of the images that you showed, and in particular the Rudolph, because as we all know, it was the Rudolph project that catalyzed Jane Jacobs to fight against that project, and that moment represents a kind of watershed in our thinking about cities and urbanism. If I were to characterize the urban thinking of the last three decades, we've been more Jane Jacobs than Paul Rudolph. So I'm interested, are you suggesting here maybe we need to revisit some of that large scale, top-down strong, centered infrastructure moment? I mean, I think it's
maniacal,
an intriguing...
Maniacal, dictatorial...
Yeah, it's an intriguing question, you know, because... I mean, because, you know, the highway across Upper Manhattan did a lot of damage as well. I mean, it has, as you say, it's got these incredible moments, but it's also, you know, it's got its problems,
well,
too.
Well, look, you know, we're big fans of opportunistic urbanism, and I think like the kind of fine-grained texture and recognize, you know, the incredible importance of Jane Jacobs as a foil to a lot of horrible... and anti-urban work that preceded her polemic. But we also, I think, have to recognize that once in a while, we do need large-scale infrastructural projects, and I think we've reached that moment where we can't solve major urban problems through a very fine-grained set of good intentions.
Perhaps I may ask. I wonder, is there an ambition to convince city officials, government officials, to really get inspired again about big projects? Because I think it would be very important to do, and I think there's a very important role for architects and designers in general to help with these processes. It's not only the architects and designers, though. But do you think talking about it again could kick things off, or...
I think, and here's a curatorial urbanist and provocateur here beginning to kickstart, hopefully, a good conversation. Because, in fact, so much of our public territory has been eroded by infrastructure and by layers of things that have been done one at a time, one after another, rather than one because of another or in conjunction with. And so if we're going to actually reclaim and grow our public territory, we must take advantage of these territories that are also defined by singular use urban ideas of movement. And all the undersides and overpasses and territories that I would say even projects like the High Line illustrate the possibility of simultaneously enjoying these in new ways, this kind of sectional project is one that we can't afford to overlook because too much of this territory is taken over for other uses.
And do you also think that there are, you know, more territories that architects might get involved in? I mean, even when I went in to talk to Michael in the office, I started to talk about the design of streets, which is obviously a big issue in New York right now. And is there a way to make, I mean, obviously there are kind of engineers involved, traffic engineering, all of that, but is there also an architectural element to some safer and better designed streets that might become part of?
Well, I'm also going to turn that question over to David. Sorry, David, but, you know, just think of what was done just, I don't know, five, eight years ago by pedestrianizing a lot of the kind of residual leftover spaces. I mean, whether that was done by a designer or an architect, it almost doesn't matter. It was done by someone who creatively could look at a condition and kind of say sometimes... by taking something away, we can add. And I think that's one of the great triumphs of the Bloomberg administration is kind of completely rethinking the positive role of streets rather than them as barriers.
My personal take on the streets is actually very frustrated at the moment. I'm not sure if you guys bike, but if you bike in the city at the moment, there's so many crazy potholes. But on a different note, I think the administration has completely given up on the streetscape. But in a more on a more serious note, so I think what is happening at the moment is actually a very interesting time. So the mayor a few weeks back starting possibly a small crusade of sorts against Times Square, and the public space that has been created and is being created there at the moment. And what you saw in the city starting to happen is that people got very nervous. There's many different opinions about Times Square. But I do think many of us do care about having more public space in the city. And perhaps this is not designed in a way that some people would want it and prefer other public spaces in the city, but there's a real value to these streetscapes that are now being used in very different ways. So I think there's something interesting happening and then backpedaling on the official level. So, yeah, good that we're still with these streetscapes that now allow for pedestrians also.
Yeah, and sorry to keep bringing Jane Jacobs into this question, but, of course, the street was so important for Jane Jacobs, precisely because it was a place where many different things could happen. And I think it does come back to this notion of program-rich infrastructures, that the infrastructures of the 50s and 60s were single-use. They were designed by engineers with very specific performative criteria. But I think this opposition between a kind of top-down, big project, infrastructure-driven idea and a smaller scale, adaptive, evolutionary point of view, that's something that architecture can bring to the table, I think. Mm-hmm. I think we can bring some kind of new ways of thinking, new ways of working, new design strategies that can start to dissolve or at least blur that boundary between the kind of top down and the bottom up. And I think the program-rich infrastructure idea is precisely where you start to do that.
I think the other thing that we shouldn't forget, and I hope there's some artists in the audience, is the power of art in an incredibly subtle way to surprise. And when Alexandra was in our office, we were talking about this, I was reminded of Burle Marx's beautiful sidewalks in Brazil, the Copacabana. What would Brazil be without those? And it's just, they're only 2 inches thick, but has completely transformed the city. And the power of art, the power of marrying architecture and infrastructure, art and infrastructure, can't be overlooked.
I like the slide you showed of the Olympic Sculpture Park, where you sort of seem to be saying that the architecture that you'd added had turned the roads themselves into an artwork, because it's like you added art that they didn't have to pay for by creating that design, and that I think is another way of architecture is a different way of looking at the city and kind of representing it in a more artistic way. Possibly way or a framed way. Quite interesting.
I was thinking, Alexander, one of the things that you do as a commentator, if you will, on design, as a provocateur, is that you often pose the obvious as something that is not obvious, but stated as obvious. And I think one of the things that you've described as, in a sense, a provocation is that our public territories are now changing, because you could say our virtual formats for communication and our physical formats are not one and the same anymore. So I think that you were talking about people being able to enter the park through the cars, passing through the cars. They can also enter the park virtually online and actually engage some of the activities that are there. And so that's sort of this other side of a kind of public terrain that I think is actually maybe making it clear that the necessity of the there in physical urban settings, in fact, is becoming even more urgent, because there's an inclination to sort of let the digital infrastructure be the one that is your place of engagement.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of cities are seeing people flock to, photogenic public spaces, and in fact, be drawn to, spaces that are popular on Instagram. So there's this, unexpected feedback loop between the digital, not as a replacement, but as kind of like a call to movement. And one of the best examples is the Chris Burden sculpture outside LACMA, which has kind of given LACMA an architectural image where it didn't have one. Mm-hmm. So it's like it almost, the building doesn't have a facade, doesn't need one. They're buying one from Peter Zumthor anyway, but that's another matter. So it's like if you make a space that people can occupy, that has a flavor, a special flavor, people will come there. I was actually one of the things you talked about also, and you showed a number of projects where you'd created these staircases, both internal and external, to kind of complicate the space and make people linger there, which seemed very appropriate for this building, because just coming in tonight, there's so many people sitting on the steps that clearly aren't oriented towards the library, but they're just oriented towards kind of sitting on the steps and watching people go by. And I feel like that's something you've incorporated into a number of projects. And it'd be interesting just to talk about kind of what you've learned about that kind of sitting.
Well, I think part of it is, our land is finite and footprints are smaller and smaller. So by necessity, particularly in a city like New York, negotiating multiple levels is the norm rather than the exception. So how do we do that architecturally? And what works and doesn't work, what becomes an impediment, I think is something that's really interesting to us, and I suspect interesting to all of us here. So I think in some ways it's almost, we kind of backed into it because of this issue of tight footprints. But I would also say that we've been interested in the topography, and the topography can be an interior topography too, as is so, I think, beautifully characterized by stairs, the kind of contouring of stairs.
I thought you were just going to say that you love people watching.
Yeah. That too.
The whole question of the necessity of inefficiency in architecture is something that we fight constantly because we have clients who want efficient buildings. And we spend an enormous amount of time arguing for inefficiency, particularly in stairs, because that's a place where a kind of common thread of engagement can emerge. And it's very interesting when you start to now talk to clients about collaboration space. All of a sudden, our passion for stairs is something that's not so much just the efficiency factor being off, but now a program-rich element growing. And so that helps tremendously to think about an urban situation where there is a kind of a geographic and social segregation that occurs in tall buildings floor by floor. And we're very, very aware that if a stair can be public in its dimension and be legible and seen, that somehow that segregation gets inverted into something more connective.
Yeah, I like the attention to inefficiencies. According to Robert Venturi, Louis Kahn once said that buildings need bad spaces as well as good spaces, and I think that's something that gets left out of the conversation. I can actually now answer Alexandra's first question. My students will be very familiar with this example, but the steps in front of Lowe Library at Columbia, for me, are just a paradigm of this kind of loosely indeterminate programmatic space. You know, that's where Columbia holds its graduation, so it can host very, very formal events. It's been a very important site for political protests, but it's also, you know, a place just day-to-day where people lounge around and eat lunch on the stairs. They have a marathon basketball game that goes on to raise money for charity on the steps. So it's a perfect example of that kind of program-rich infrastructure. Yet the design of it, you know, it's totally classical. It's got an equestrian statue in the middle of it. So it's very interesting the way that the kind of semiotic clues for the space and the actual use of the space are somewhat at odds with one another. Another thing about those steps is that the trend to riser dimension is such that it encourages you to walk diagonally instead of straight up. And so it does at some point, you know, come down to very simple questions of measure and material as well.
Well, no, I was actually going to give the twist back to the to infrastructure. I think there's such an interesting word, because I am thinking much bigger infrastructure, I think, and I have the feeling that you want to go there, but much of the work, of course, driven by clients and great institutions that you work for, are building size. And I wonder if there's an ambition to really go and do big dams or God knows what. But
do you have a dam, David, that you...
Yeah, in my back pocket.
It's really interesting. As a kid, we traveled regularly to visit all the TVA projects. So every one of those dams were very much part of the legacy of these, you know, cross-country drives and the white-walled, tired station wagon. But the real question is, architectural projects tend to come in building-to-building size spaces, and we've always tended to want to grab an engagement with broader territories. So precisely, yes, would we want to embrace this kind of larger terrain of thinking, both strategic and territorial? Absolutely.
And then to add to it, actually, I was on the train this afternoon and thinking about the infrastructure that you see along the train lines. And the tricky thing there is that you can design the most fantastic things, and of course we have seen really beautiful things being designed here. But then the issue becomes like there's sometimes so little thinking about what happens after you open it. Lack of maintenance, it's just no idea. And how can you build it into your designs? And also, how can you convince your clients that they actually have to do some of that work?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And very rarely do we as designers have an opportunity to kind of go back. Seattle was an exception. We went back 5 years after it opened recently. And we're able to see how the park was used, and also how the park was programmed curatorially, how the art pieces were perceived, and that kind of engagement between the park and the art was really a very open-ended question. There are a number of new art pieces. There's a Jaume Plensa on the waterfront that's really fantastic. So one wishes that would happen more often, but rarely does that happen, and it's... It's sad, actually. I think our culture is very much driven by sort of short-term goals. You finish the building, we'll move on. A developer leases the building out, that's it. There's no sort of sense of the kind of conditional use, the appropriation over time.
This is another of those sort of lessons from landscape, right? I mean, yep. The famously landscape architects work to the construction budget. Landscape architects have to work to the maintenance budget. And again, landscape architects will tell you how frustrating it is. You can't photograph anything until 10 years after the project is completed. So, you wonder what would happen if you made this rule for architects, right? Can't photograph the building when it's finished. You have to photograph it 10 years later, you know? But I wonder, I mean, are there examples context where you've been anticipating that kind of change? In other words, maintenance issues, that's a kind of negative, right? But again, there are certainly a generation of landscape architects who are embracing the possibility of the project changing over time as part of the fundamental potential of landscape.
Yeah. I think, in fact, Alexander, maybe that the Seattle slide can come up. You're touching on something very, very interesting, which is that we felt very blessed that there was as a client, the Seattle Art Museum is very used to curating and caring for museums. They were a little less experienced at curating and caring for a landscape, but the first thing they said was that we're going to actually not only raise money for the building and for the landscape, but we're going to raise money for an annual maintenance that we'll throw off and be able to look after it at about $2 million a year. Now, if you think about that, what a visionary idea, and I think that this whole notion of entropy, change, and weathering could actually improve through growth and change. The identity of a place is something that also... If you look at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, what a curatorially minded client to weather, groom, and change that landscape and care for it. So those are visionary clients that are few and far between, and arguably you could say that the churches of hundreds and hundreds of years ago were those dream clients where they believed in something that would have a longer life beyond even the original builders. That's shifted to museums more often than not, where you can count on a curatorial care enduring with the after the invention, if you will, of the project. And so the real question is there a will or an ambition to extend that broader, far-sighted thinking about care and maintenance out there?
Yeah, care very often, but it can also be suffocating in many ways. And what is interesting also when you think about big infrastructure is could it allow for more flexibility? And the reason why I have to think of that is museums can be... very inflexible places, know from experience. Could you build it into museum structures, but also could you build it into much bigger infrastructures, perhaps? And we haven't talked much about your social infrastructure part of the book, but...
It's interesting, David, because the Seattle Art Museum, like any museums like it, is extraordinarily stratified and is like a slow-moving battleship. The thing that was lucky for us here is they had never done a sculpture park. So the kind of organizational decision-making was completely preempted. There was a brilliant curator, Lisa Corin, with lots of ideas, and actually a fledgling art collection. Most sculpture parks, most museums, new museums, are built around a collection. The only piece of this is an improbable fact. The only piece of art when this project started its design was the Calder sculpture, the red sculpture. And a lot of the pieces came from local collections, but always in response to a kind of design idea, which is completely antithetical to how museums work. So we were very lucky that there wasn't a precedent in Seattle. So sometimes innocence is actually a really, and naivete is should be prized much more highly.
This may be related to your social question, but I'm just curious, going back to Seattle 5 years later, are there parts of that project that work differently than you expected? I mean, because I think that's the other, it's not just about the maintenance, it's also, I mean, architects make a lot of assumptions, earned and unearned, about human behavior, and I'm just curious, you know, did the curators, do users just do things really differently than you were expecting in parts of that park?
We found out that the dog walking community was one of the most vociferous supporters of this park. Who would have guessed? We never thought about dogs. I guarantee you that.
You know, it's very interesting. We also discovered that, like Ian Pace East Wing, that the point became the most rubbed edge of that building, and this point became the most visited point right over the highway, that dead center over the highway. And as a result, in our five-year return project where we're rejuvenating certain edges, there are now these dark black cobbles that just are in their own triangular shape so that people can stand there securely as opposed to standing in the damp grass. So those sorts of things, literally the clarity of those points, in another case where it was kind of wearing thin between the grass and the paving, we pulled up yet another concrete curb like we did there at the centerpiece to create seating and actually create discrete boundaries between landscape and the architectural edges. So I think our idea of blurring boundaries became more blurred than they wanted to be. And so that was part of our return project, which was to clarify those points once again.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've been thinking a little bit about what you've been saying, and I maybe other people have figured this out faster than I did, but it seems to me more and more today our public spaces are curated. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the High Line obviously is a very good example. High Line is a super curated public space. And I'm not sure I'm totally on board with that. I think you're absolutely correct in identifying that as a phenomenon, and clearly there's potential there, we have to work with it, but I would get a little bit nervous if our entire public realm becomes curated. I just want to register a little bit of nervousness about that as a long-term prospect. So
how do you feel about the debate on Times Square and the revelatory, if you will, performances that have been inhibiting the idea of the public realm?
Well, but again, I think this is the price you pay for publicness. You know, some things are going to happen in public spaces you may not want. And if you start to control that too much, that's a kind of slippery slope that I don't want to go down.
I was sitting with a city agency yesterday, not here in town, but in D.C., and they were talking about a new series of parks that I wanted to start programming. And I was listening to it, and I was like, oh, my God, it sounds like it's all of these things that you're referring to now, but then combined, yeah. And for the next 100 years. And I was like, how are we going to stay interested in that? And I wonder, and I have a feeling in 5 years we'll lose interest, and you need to have a much more flexible system that you can then start tapping into from a community side. It should really be a community that is taking over at some point.
I mean, part of the success of the stairs you mentioned at Columbia or any important urban space is they're incredibly simple and not undesigned, but very subtly designed so that they become, in a way, an arena for all sorts of programs that 20 years from now none of us can anticipate. And so sometimes maybe doing less in the public realm. And that's very hard because I think, particularly where parks are concerned, and even buildings, there's a tendency to over-program.
Well, to the notion of blurring boundaries has come up, I think, in a couple of different areas tonight. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about was about the distinction between architecture and landscape. And it sounds like even when, you know, you went back to this project, you were tinkering a little bit with some edges there. And, I mean, you mentioned in your presentation working with a number of landscape architects, but obviously you are also working, you know, on the landscape. So do you see that as an unnecessary distinction, an increasingly blurred distinction, or what?
You know, the whole idea of disciplinary boundaries is a product, if you will, of our institutions and our licensing sorts of tools. And so the differentiation between an architect, a landscape architect, an urbanist, an ecologist, and an artist are set up for good reasons. There's a need for disciplinary sort of, you know, clarity for some things. But in fact, for a broader synthetic public project, then, those kinds of boundaries become less productive. And we found ourselves, in part because our practice began, the first thing we actually built was a park, and that was a competition that we won. We began in the world of landscape and found ourselves professionally working from landscape towards architecture. And so you could say that it's a sustained sensibility that launched us. And so those boundaries have seemed more artificial to us than natural.
Stan, David, do you see that as something that's happening, you know, across the professions, or something, you know, more particular to their practice?
No, it's certainly happening across the profession. It's been happening for a while. I think if you go back to the 1990s, there was this upsurge of interest on the part of architects in landscape for a number of different reasons. Many of which we've been talking about already. I think, for me, landscape offers three primary areas that are attractive and interesting to architects. First of all, it's a model for smooth interconnectivity. Clearly, and many of the Weissman-Frady projects do that. They use landscape strategies to connect sectionally but also horizontally. It's a model for open-ended programming, right? That's another thing landscapes do. You know, you don't have a room which is labeled an auditorium, a classroom, a cafeteria, but you know, you have spaces that are available for indeterminate programmatic appropriation. And then the other thing we've been talking about is landscapes change over time. And again, I think as we try and, you know, as we start becoming more and more conscious about ecology and evolution, the notion that cities and buildings can actually adapt and change over time is an incredibly attractive one. So no. I mean, I think it's pretty evident this is a very broad level of engagement. But I think for me, what's interesting about your practice is precisely what you said, that you start as architects working in the territory of landscape, and have always sort of moved back and forth without, I think you sort of respect disciplinary expertise, and I'm sure all of your projects have large teams with people who bring different expertise. This is a very extended answer, but I think it has to do also with where landscape architecture is now from where it was 20, 30 years ago. 20, 30 years ago, landscape architecture was very dominated by a kind of narrative-based mode. They were looking at land art, and landscape architecture, if you will, had very small ambitions. I think as the ambitions of landscape architecture have gotten larger, architecture and landscape have somehow met somewhere in the middle. And a lot of the questions that then come out of that territory where they overlap speak to a skill set that is actually quite similar within landscape architecture and architecture. It's about the organization of space. It's about movement and flow. And, you know, it's about infrastructure. It's less about very, very specific things like the design of plants and, the creation of small-scale public spaces that were sort of characteristic of landscape architecture in the 70s and the 80s. So it's as much a case that landscape architecture has moved, architecture has moved, and they've met somewhere in the middle.
Perhaps to add to that, so if you're talking about interdisciplinary work or working across disciplines, it also very much becomes about how you collaborate between disciplines. And you all teach. You spent a lot of time in reviews also. And I wonder how you can set up for collaboration in much more effective ways. I still have the feeling that, for instance, if I look at the projects that we run, we organize design competitions with Van Allen Institute, is that there's on the side of the architect or the landscape architect, there's still often a drive to want to run the project. and more we're pushing for, well, perhaps it's not led by you guys. Perhaps it is led by an experience designer or by a social scientist, a neuroscientist for that matter. But I wonder how you can build in education, or how you can push in education more for collaboration that goes beyond the designer always leading the team. And this is a dangerous question to ask to designers.
I'd like to say that design covers a lot of ground. And design is actually something that's owned by engineers, by ecologists, by politicians, etc. The notion of design actually, in many ways, is about putting together improbably unrelated things so that some kind of clarity of something can move forward. So maybe the question would be not so much whether it's run or not run by designers, but who better than designers to run something when there's improbable sorts of things that would allow you to do one expensive thing after another to solve each and every single problem? Mm-hmm. It would be potentially risking enormous expense with very little benefit. So that's the benefit of an architect actually leading this charge, to actually find common threads and ultimately maybe identify the least demanding yet most extraordinary answer.
In large-scale projects like this, the first thing you have to do is actually design the process.
Yeah. And the designing the process is something, of course, as a designer, that you can do well. But is there a way to allow for... I have to think of the... I forget his name, but at some point a few years back, you guys introduced me to... I think he was involved in the Brooklyn Garden on the roof. The nature guy who was living up in...
Pat Colina?
Exactly. Yeah. So there was some interesting synergy, I think, between the three of you, because I had a feeling he was really driving part of that project forward and you guys taking another part, and it was quite beautiful to see.
Yeah. Well, I think, actually, and this may sound contradictory, but for collaborations to work, you do need disciplinary expertise, because the last thing you want to do is talk to a landscape architect who doesn't know anything about horticulture. Last thing you want to do is talk about an architect who doesn't know how to, you know, make things, or a planner who doesn't know how to plan. So I think the great successes of collaboration have meant that the people who are collaborating are very clear about the kinds of things they can bring to the table. We actually had an epiphany, David, and I would maybe make the argument that Marion was alluding to, that design is important. We were doing a master plan for Flushing, Queens, which at the time, about when our practice was starting, about 15 years ago, was a very interesting and divergent and changing place. So we had a traffic engineer who came to the community and talked about traffic. We had an economist who came and talked about the changing economic picture. We had a demographer who came and talked about the changing demographics. We had a sociologist, a community activist. And then finally someone raised their hand and said, well, what are you guys going to do? And they looked to us. And, you know, it was very clear that somebody, whether it was an architect, a landscape architect, or a designer, had to pull these different things together. And somehow we thought if we had all the right experts around the table, things would magically somehow coalesce into something beautiful.
On that note, Michael, and Marion, and Stan, and David, and Alexandra, thank you so much for this brilliant discussion and the presentation in the beginning. It is now time to move on to the book sale and book signing. Thank you again.